ASDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. Israel has blocked food and supplies to Gaza for 2 months. The country says it will open new aid centers in one part of Gaza guarded by Israeli military. We hear about conditions on the ground on Morning Edition from NPR News. The Trump administration chooses a side in a case challenging access to abortion medication. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Amy Martinez. It wants the case tossed, the same position the Biden administration took. What do we know about Trump's abortion strategy? Also, an art installation that turns a Ukrainian train into a canvas, and a fantasy sports game where you build a team of papal contenders. It's Tuesday, May 6th. On this day in 1998 in Wrigley Field, Chicago Cubs pitcher Kerry Wood struck out 20 Houston Astros to tie the Major League Baseball record. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney is set to visit President Trump at the White House today. NPR's Deepa Shivaram says the Canadian leader just won election to office last week.
The thing to keep in mind about Carney is that he won this election running with an anti-Trump message. Canadians were voting as Trump was ramping up his tariff war, and Trump continues to say he wants to make Canada into America's 51st state. So the election there was seen as a referendum against Trump.
NPR's Deepa Shivaram. Reporting. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth has ordered a 20% reduction in the U.S. military's top brass. He's singling out cuts to four-star generals and admirals. Hegseth released a video online saying the cuts are not meant to punish high-ranking officers. He says the reduction will, quote, shift resources from bloated headquarters elements to warfighters. But the ranking member of the Senate Armed Services Committee, Jack Reed, says getting rid of the nation's top military officers won't help the U.S. military be more efficient. It could cripple it. Stocks opened lower this morning as the Commerce Department reported a widening of the nation's trade gap. NPR's Scott Horsley has more.
The nation's trade deficit jumped to a record high, topping $140 billion in March, a 14% increase from the previous month. Imports jumped nearly 4.5% as businesses and consumers raced to stock up on foreign goods before worldwide tariffs took effect. Exports were also up during the month, but just barely. The rush of international trade is expected to slow now that President Trump has imposed the highest import taxes since at least the 1930s. Policymakers at the Federal Reserve will be weighing the fallout from the president's trade war as they begin a two-day meeting here in Washington. The central bank will announce its decision on interest rates at the conclusion of that meeting. They're expected to hold steady. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Hamas says there is, quote, no point in dealing with Israel to find a new ceasefire and hostage release deal. The comments come after Israel announced plans to greatly expand its military offensive in Gaza and take control of all food aid distributed in the enclave. And NPR's Carrie Khan has more from Tel Aviv.
Bassem Naim, a senior Hamas official, posted on social media that further talks with Israel are pointless given its, quote, starvation war in Gaza. Naim urged the international community to pressure Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to end, quote, the crimes of hunger, thirst, and killings. Israel has blocked all aid into Gaza for more than 2 months. Its cabinet approved the new plan, which would seize the territory, move nearly all of Gaza's population to the south, and take total control of all food and aid distribution, unless Hamas surrenders and releases the hostages still held in Gaza. Israel says it will wait to implement the plan, however, until after President Trump's trip to the region later this month. Carrie Khan, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
On Wall Street, the Dow is down 340 points. It's NPR. The Israeli military is striking Yemen again. The Israeli military has already carried out multiple strikes against a key port in Yemen. This week, Houthi rebels in Yemen fired a missile into central Israel. The U.S. has been bombing Yemen every day for about 7 weeks. The Houthis have been attacking shipping in the Red Sea. The Houthis say they are supporting Hamas militants fighting Israel. The Trump administration is asking a federal judge if it can drop a controversial lawsuit. The lawsuit is trying to restrict access to an abortion pill, mifepristone. This action is surprising because it is the same stance taken by the Biden administration. The next step in the case is for the judge to decide. Catholic cardinals are approaching the election of a new pope with prayer and reflection. NPR's Jason DeRose reports from Rome. The papal conclave begins tomorrow at the Vatican.
Church politics, social issues, and international affairs are certainly on the minds of the cardinals, but a papal conclave is also a deeply religious undertaking, marked by masses, prayers, hymns, and oaths. Cardinal-elector Michael Cherny says his brother cardinals approach the task with great seriousness.
We're looking for a Holy Father who is the successor of St. Peter, not the successor of Pope Francis.
Following a public mass in St. Peter's Basilica Wednesday morning, cardinals will enter the Sistine Chapel. Voting continues until they elect the next leader of the world's 1.4 billion Catholics. Jason DeRose, NPR News, Rome.
Pope Francis died of heart failure at the age of 88 last month following a stroke. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C. Good morning. Israel says it will relocate the people in Gaza and set up aid centers run by U.S. security contractors. In a few minutes, we'll find out about the conditions in Gaza right now. But first,
the Trump administration has been fairly quiet on abortion so far.
But on Monday, Trump's Justice Department asked the federal court to dismiss a case that could seriously restrict access to abortion nationally.
NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin has been following this particular case for several years now. So tell us about this case, Selena.
Well, it's challenging the Food and Drug Administration's rules about mifepristone, which is one of the pills used for medication abortion. It's also used to manage miscarriages. And if you're thinking, didn't the Supreme Court already reject that case? You would be right, kind of. The justices last year rejected the original challenge brought by a group of Christian doctors. But now three states, Missouri, Idaho, and Kansas, have intervened. They're arguing essentially they can't ban abortion if residents can receive this medication through the mail. So they're taking up this challenge to FDA's decisions about medication abortion again.
So that's what the Trump administration's Justice Department wants to dismiss?
Yeah, exactly. They took that position in a filing on Monday. And this was a bit surprising because that's the same position the Biden administration's Justice Department had made. And you might not expect a lot of continuity when it comes to abortion between these two administrations.
Does that mean, though, that the Trump administration is planning to go easy on new abortion restrictions this time around? Because the president has pointed out many times that the justices that he appointed were responsible for overturning Roe v. Wade.
Yeah, I don't think that's necessarily what it means. That's in part because the federal judge in Texas who's presiding, Judge Matthew Kaczmarek, is known to be very receptive to anti-abortion arguments. So this case might continue regardless of what the Trump administration wants to do. Also, this is not the only tool in the Trump administration's toolbox when it comes to restricting abortion. Katie Keith is the director of the Georgetown Center for Health Policy and the Law and formerly served on Biden's Gender Policy Council.
I would say the jury is still out essentially, of how aggressive the Trump administration is going to be on medication abortion.
She says if they want to restrict access, they could. For example, the Trump administration's FDA could just go ahead and add restrictions on who can get this medication and how without being required to by the court.
You think the FDA would do that?
You know, it's hard to predict. The new FDA commissioner, Marty Makary, said publicly in April there were, quote, no plans for FDA to restrict mifepristone, but plans can change. This is a medication that's been approved for almost 25 years. It's been found to be safe and effective in ending a pregnancy, along with another medication called misoprostol. And it's a medication that's used globally. The World Health Organization says it can be used safely in the first trimester of pregnancy without the direct supervision of a healthcare provider. The FDA here in this country made the same determination. And what's happened since Roe v. Wade was overturned nearly 3 years ago is that half of states have banned abortion, but the total number of abortions nationally has gone up, in part because people have been able to get this medication through the mail. There are a lot of ways that the Trump administration could try to tamp down on that outside of this court case if it wants to, and that's what remains to be seen.
All right, NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin covers health policies. Selena, thanks.
You're welcome.
Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says Israel will seize more land in Gaza and that the army will remain in parts of the strip indefinitely. The military has begun calling up reservists in preparation for what Netanyahu calls an intensive escalation of the war. Israel has imposed a full blockade on Gaza for 2 months now. Hunger is widespread. Under this new plan, the Israeli government would shut down hundreds of soup kitchens and aid centers around Gaza and push residents to the south, near the border with Egypt. That's where it would set up new aid centers run by American security contractors. Israel says this will isolate Hamas, which it accuses of stealing aid. We want to know what the conditions are like now, so we've called Shayna Lowe. She's a communications advisor with the Norwegian Refugee Council, an independent humanitarian organization. Shayna Lowe, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
When is the last time your group was able to deliver aid into Gaza, and what do you know about conditions on the ground there now?
Well, we last brought aid into Gaza over 2 months ago, before Israel implemented this complete siege that has prevented any aid or goods from entering Gaza for over 2 months now. Yesterday, we actually distributed the very last of our stocks of shelter supplies and hygiene kits for families in need. And now we are quite literally out of aid. We continue to provide water to displacement sites and soft services like legal aid and protection services, but we are increasingly limited as the situation on the ground gets more and more dire. Our teams are seeing hunger spread and needs continue to grow as Israel bombardments continue.
You still have workers there, but they just don't have anything to distribute. Is that right?
That is right. We have around 70 staff on the ground in Gaza. Most of them are national staff from Gaza serving their communities. And right now, due to both the lack of aid and the insecurity that they are facing, we've had to severely limit and curtail our operations.
What are they telling you that is most critically needed in Gaza right now?
You know, it's really difficult to say what's most critically needed. Of course, food is at the top of the list. People are going hungry. Community kitchens have already started shutting down. But on top of that, there's need for clean water, fuel to keep operations running and generators and hospitals running, medicine, shelter, tents. Over a million people need tents in Gaza as displacement continues.
So, you know, the UN was asked to participate in this new system that I just described, but the UN said it would not cooperate because the plan amounts to using aid as a weapon of war to try to achieve military objectives. Has your organization been asked to participate, and has your organization taken a decision about whether you would?
We have been very outspoken, and our Secretary General, Jan Egelin, has been very outspoken about the fact that we will not participate in systems and schemes that undermine our ability to deliver aid and adhere to humanitarian principles of independence, impartiality, and neutrality. We are committed to serving Palestinians throughout Gaza, wherever they are, with the goods and services that they require.
Do you know of any organization planning to participate?
It's hard to know. There are rumors spreading, but I think the aid system has come out very strongly. We saw a joint statement from the heads of UN agencies in the occupied Palestinian territory, along with international and Palestinian NGOs, rejecting this scheme and reaffirming our willingness, our eagerness to deliver aid in a way that is principled and protects both humanitarian workers and the people who we are there to serve.
But that has to be difficult, though, because if it's the choice of getting aid in even under these conditions and not getting any in at all, that has to be a dilemma.
Of course, we are eager to serve people, but we also know that aid cannot and should not be weaponized in order to move civilian populations or achieve military goals, and that's a red line that we are just unwilling to cross.
Before we let you go, very briefly, I'm sure you're aware of the Trump administration's basically shutting down USAID. Has that had any impact on your operations?
It's certainly had an impact on NRC's operations globally. We did not have much U.S. aid funding in our operations in Palestine, but we're seeing the cutting of U.S. aid funding impact our partners and peers throughout the occupied Palestinian territory and their ability to deliver life-saving assistance.
That's Shayna Lowe with the Norwegian Refugee Council. Shayna Lowe, thank you so much for joining us and sharing these insights with us.
Thank you.
The American collagist Barbara Kruger is known for her provocative art about power and identity. She's unveiled a new installation in Ukraine's capital of Kyiv, inscribed on a passenger train. NPR's Hanna Palomarenko says it's intended to show solidarity with Ukraine during the war.
This high-speed intercity train is about to depart from Kyiv's main station. Barbara Kruger and the Ribbon International Project transformed the train's exterior into a canvas. The artwork is called Untitled Another Again, and it includes a poem in Ukrainian covering 9 train cars. Curator Maria Izerlis reads lines of the poem in English.
Another smile, another tear, another hope, another fear, another love, another year.
The rhythm of the words is supposed to evoke the sound of a moving train. Next to Izerlis is Oleksandr Pertsovsky, board chairman of Ukrainian Railways.
Railway operates spaces which could be public spaces where people who do not have access to galleries, to museums, but they would get a little bit of a touch of this arts and culture.
He says trains can be so much more than transportation.
It's also very important symbolically to show Ukrainians that world most renowned artists stand by Ukraine. They do not give up on Ukraine.
The ceremony opening the art project begins. It starts with a minute of silence to commemorate the fallen railroad workers.
Slava Ukraine.
We keep hearing that there is a sort of peace talks.
Over the last few weeks, Russian attacks have killed and wounded more of Pertsovsky's colleagues.
But every morning when I wake up to the operational reports and I see that our energy infrastructure, our core railway infrastructure, our port infrastructure being attacked, like what is peace? Is this missile? Is a peace treaty?
The train with Kruger's art installation will travel in Ukraine and abroad for 2 months. It carries a message of Ukraine's reality, facing the war and moving on no matter what. Hanna Palomarenko, NPR News, Kyiv.
This is NPR News.
on the next Fresh Air. Emmy winner and Oscar nominee Michelle Williams. In the new limited TV series, Dying for Sex, she plays a woman who finds out she's dying of cancer and decides to leave her unhappy marriage and her life behind to seek pleasure and sexual satisfaction. Williams will tell us about portraying characters experiencing grief, loss, and resilience. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Progressive Insurance. Progressive is looking for dedicated and forward-thinking individuals to join their growing team. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. From the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Amy Martinez. House Democrats are looking ahead to the 2026 midterms, hammering out a strategy to take back the majority. One person helping shape that strategy is Representative Susan DelBene of Washington State. She chairs House Democrats' official campaign arm, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. Her party needs three more seats to win back the majority from Republicans. And when we spoke yesterday, I asked DelBene what the maps look like right now for House Democrats.
We've got opportunities all across the country, multiple seats in places like Pennsylvania, Michigan, Arizona. And this represents swing districts. It represents districts where Republicans are not serving their communities with representatives that are much more extreme than their communities. We're recruiting great candidates to run in all of those districts. So we've got 35 districts that are on our map so far across the country.
Okay, 35 districts. Is there an overall unifying message that the Democratic Party wants to send to the voters of these districts?
Well, the number one issue in the last election was about lowering costs. Absolutely, the economy is top of mind right now. And what they've seen from Trump and Republican Congress is anything but a focus on costs. It's a broken promise from Republicans. Costs have gone up. Tariff policy has really created an uncertain economy and is a drag on the economy right now. Prices are going up for families. So that absolutely be a number one issue. And the tax on health care, including proposed cuts they have to Medicaid, massive cuts to Medicaid, will also be devastating for families across the country.
The vice chair of the Democratic National Committee is David Hogg, and he says he plans to invest some $20 million from his political action committee to back primary challengers to Democrats. Do you agree with him that Democrats need a big shakeup in order to win?
I think we are united in one incredibly important goal, which is taking back the majority in the House of Representatives. We only need three more seats to do that. And we've already seen in those Florida special elections at the beginning of April, the margins that Republicans have held on to seats like those diminish rapidly. That was just a few months since the November election. So we know the American people are with us, and our goal is to make sure we take back those gavels, make Hakeem Jeffries Speaker of the House, and have a voice that's going to stand up for the American people in Congress.
But does challenging incumbent Democrats give the perception that the party is fighting within itself as opposed to just only trying to take down Republicans?
Well, I think we are united in taking back the House. We're going to be focused on making sure that our current incumbents who are in those swing districts across the country have the resources to run their strong campaigns, get reelected, and then we're going to be on offense across the country to make sure we pick up seats.
Even if Democrats do take the House, Donald Trump will still be president and the Senate majority is not guaranteed. What are House Democrats able to deliver even with a balance of power like that?
Well, in the House, having the gavels makes an incredible difference. We can have hearings. We can move legislation. We can stop legislation. Right now, we're not having debates in Congress. Republicans aren't holding hearings. You haven't seen Elon Musk in a hearing talking about the damage that he's done. They are hiding. They are just rubber stamping the actions of this administration. Having a Congress that actually will stand up and do its job can make an incredible difference. And when we have the majority, we can do that.
Susan Del Bene represents Washington State's 1st Congressional District, and she also chairs the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. Congresswoman, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Who will be the next pope? That's the question flying around cafes, bars, and restaurants in Italy.
It's also the focus of a new online game.
We wanted to connect with a sensation we usually have during the conclaves, in which basically everyone is talking about who the next pope is going to be.
That's Mauro Vanetti, co-creator of Fantapapa.
Think fantasy soccer, but you're picking 11 cardinals.
If you guess the cardinal that's becoming the next pope as your captain, you get 1,000 points. If you placed that cardinal in another slot, you get 500 points only.
Even if you don't pick the right pope as captain, all is not lost.
You also score points for cardinals that are not elected, but they are mentioned in the national press agency, ANSA, or in the major newspapers in Italy.
So Italian cardinals would be a boost to your team. Co-creator Pietro Pace says Italians are the leading choice of the more than 70,000 Fantapapa players.
Zuppi and Parolin are very, very, very close.
He's talking about Cardinals Matteo Zuppi and Pietro Parolin.
There are other ways to score points.
You have to guess the name of the new pope, the papal name.
For example, Cardinal Jorge Bergoglio became Pope Francis.
And there are other details to guess.
If the pope wear the eyeglasses, for example, during the Habemus Papa, the introduction of the pope to the people inside Piazza San Pietro.
That's the announcement of the new pontiff in St. Peter's Square. Simone D'Alessio is playing the game. He's an architect based in Rome.
I live just 2 kilometers from the Vatican City. So in these days, it's totally a mess in the city center. When we go in the morning to have a cappuccino, the bartender says me, so who will be the new pope?
D'Alessio's got his pick.
My captain is Parolin, but the other, I think, could be Tago from Filippini and Fernandez from España.
So another vote for Cardinal Parolin, but with Cardinals Luis Taglay of the Philippines and Cardinal Angel Fernandez of Spain also on the team. Once players make their selections, they can join a league with friends. Like the Cardinals, team selections are locked in once the conclave begins tomorrow.
In Italy, betting on the identity of the next pope is usually frowned on, so you can't wager money while playing Fantapapa. Co-creator Pace says the winner will receive something much better.
You can have eternal glory because you are the one guessing the pope.
And eternal glory is why I play all fantasy sports, Michelle.
Well, good luck, eh?
I will try. This is NPR News.
The desire to have kids can be overwhelming for some parents, but maybe more people are on the fence than we realize.
Maternal ambivalence is the norm, and yet we're told that people that are hell yes are the norm.
Writer Ruthie Ackerman explains the less talked about paths to parenthood and her new book on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Canada's newly elected Prime Minister, Mark Carney, will be at the White House today for talks with President Trump. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, Trump and Carney are expected to talk about trade, tariffs, and relations between the two countries.
Carney's trip comes as Trump has again voiced the notion of Canada as the 51st state. How Carney deals with that could set the stage for future talks. Carney has insisted that Canadian sovereignty is not up for discussion. Instead, the Prime Minister is looking to begin a comprehensive set of talks on tariffs, trade, and security in a broader Canada-U.S. relationship.
Carney describes a phone call he had with Trump last week as very constructive. Democratic attorneys general in 20 states, including California and New York, are suing the Trump administration over its mass firings in the Department of Health and Human Services. Letitia James is the Attorney General of New York.
This is not how government is supposed to work. These actions are dangerous, cruel, and illegal. They defy Congress's authority, and they violate federal law.
About 20,000 employees at HHS agencies have been laid off as part of the president's efforts to downsize the federal government. They include the Food and Drug Administration and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. This is NPR News. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth is directing the Pentagon to reduce the number of senior military officers. In a memo, Hegseth calls for a 20% cut in the number of four-star generals and admirals on active duty. He's also calling for fewer generals in the National Guard. Hegseth says the changes are meant to shift resources from what he calls bloated headquarters elements to warfighters. More than a dozen former employees of the data mining company Palantir are speaking out against the company's work with the Trump administration. As NPR's Bobby Allen reports, the ex-employees at Palantir say the technology is being used to identify the real-time movements of migrants who are in the U.S. illegally.
13 ex-Palantir workers say the Trump administration is abusing the data mining tools they helped build. The former employees note that Palantir's advanced surveillance software is helping Immigration and Customs Enforcement track migrants in real time. The letter, shared exclusively with NPR, says Palantir's own code of conduct says its software should not be used to violate people's rights. The letter says, quote, "Early Palantirians understood the ethical weight of building these technologies. These principles have now been violated and are rapidly being dismantled at Palantir Technologies and across Silicon Valley." Palantir and the White House did not return requests for comment. Bobby Allen, NPR News.
On Wall Street, the Dow was down 163 points. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from National Geographic Lindblad Expeditions, committed to taking travelers deeper into the wonders of planet Earth. Each expedition cruise is guided by a diverse team. NatGeoExpeditions.com/cruises. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California. The film industry started the week with a little confusion.
That was after President Trump announced on Truth Social that he was imposing a 100% tariff on movies produced outside the U.S. On Sunday night, he posted that, quote, "The movie industry in America is dying a very fast death. Other countries are offering all sorts of incentives to draw our filmmakers and studios away from the United States," unquote.
NPR entertainment correspondent Mandalit Del Barco joins us now to talk about this. So, Mandalit, the basic question is probably going to spring up more questions. So how would a 100% tariff on films made outside the U.S. actually work?
Yeah, that's exactly what everyone in Hollywood and in film and TV industries around the world would like to know. President Trump's initial announcement was surprising. It left so many questions. Who would have to pay a tariff? The studios, film distributors? Will ticket prices go up? Would this be for international films or for American films shooting or filming on location or on sound stages around the world? What about TV and streaming shows? There have been a lot of emergency closed-door meetings, group chats, and social media speculation. Studios have been quiet so far, but the head of IATSE, the union representing behind-the-scenes entertainment workers, says any plan must not harm the U.S. or Canadian film industries.
The president says other countries are offering incentives to attract movie studios and filmmakers. So can you tell us about the incentives that he was referring to? I know that you have been reporting on this.
Yeah, that's right. And it's true that for decades, places like Canada, the UK, Australia, and really all over the world, they've offered productions generous tax incentives, rebates, and grants to shoot or film in their countries. Some have even built new sound stages to entice productions wanting to cut costs. Trump says the global incentives are a threat to the national security.
Okay, so what are people overseas saying about this announcement from Trump?
You can imagine studios and unions around the world are worried that this could spell the end of their own production industries. Some wonder if countries will retaliate with their own tariffs on American films. Yesterday, President Trump told reporters he wants to meet the film industry in this country to make sure they're happy with his plan to bring back showbiz jobs.
Hollywood doesn't do very much of that business. They have the nice sign and everything's good, but they don't do very much.
All right, so why do you think this issue came up at all for President Trump?
Well, I'll give you a hint. John Voight. Trump calls the actor one of his special ambassadors, along with Sylvester Stallone and Mel Gibson. In a video shared with NPR, Voight calls Trump the greatest president since Abe Lincoln and his friend.
Who loves the entertainment business, wants to see Hollywood thrive and make films bigger and greater than ever before.
Now, John Voight says he presented Trump a plan to rescue the American film industry with federal tax incentives, co-production treaties with other countries, and subsidies for theater owners and film and TV production companies. Late last week, Voight also met with California Senator Ben Allen, who co-authored a state bill that would expand film and TV incentives, along with California Governor Gavin Newsom's plan to more than double the state's production tax credits. Trump blamed the governor for allowing productions to leave California, but late last night, Newsom said in a statement that he wants to team up with the Trump administration to create a $7.5 billion federal film tax credit.
All right, that's NPR's Mandalit del Barco. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, eh?
President Trump and House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries do not agree on much, but they both support legislation to ban members of Congress from trading individual stocks. NPR congressional correspondent Deirdre Walsh reports on the possible revival of the bipartisan effort.
President Trump's April tariff announcement and the pause a few days later prompted a flurry of stock trades by members of Congress, raising questions about whether any got a heads up. But Missouri Republican Senator Josh Hawley says the problem isn't new.
I think that this happens all the time. I do think that it makes the point.
The point, he says, is that lawmakers should be banned from investing in individual stocks. He introduced a bill recently after a bipartisan bill stalled last year.
It is a distraction at best. It is a source of potential corruption at worst, and we've seen instances of that.
But this year, he points out that President Trump told Time magazine he'd sign a bill. News, he said, was huge.
So for him to publicly now say that he thinks this is a good idea, I think is a big deal. I think that is hugely helpful. It takes away a talking point of some people say, oh, it doesn't matter if we pass it, this will never get signed.
Rhode Island Democrat Seth Magaziner, the lead sponsor on a bipartisan House bill, points out that Hakeem Jeffries, the top House Democrat, became the first leader of either party to endorse a ban.
I think we've gained more momentum in the last 2 weeks than had been achieved in the last 2 years.
Magaziner says there's overwhelming public support, and Trump's tariff announcements were a catalyst for more chatter around the issue among members. Georgia Republican Marjorie Taylor Greene's was the most public example of members making trades of stocks that gained value in that time period.
Because whether anybody with inside information traded off of those announcements or not, they were just a very stark example of what could be possible when it comes to insider trading in Washington.
He says the ball is in House Speaker Mike Johnson's court. Johnson told NPR he's not opposed to the idea, but says if there's a consensus, he'll act on it.
And it's been talked about for quite some time, but there's probably a reason that the bill hasn't moved in all those years, because there's never been consensus built around it. But I mean, I'm open to the conversation. I don't trade stocks.
Texas Republican Chip Roy says he's going to force the issue.
We're going to be voting on a stock trade ban for congressional members this year.
Both the House and Senate bills would ban lawmakers and their spouses from trading individual stocks. They set up a transition period to shift investments into blind trusts or mutual funds, and a similar transition for incoming members of Congress, and penalties for those who don't comply. Hawley says a lot of members campaigned on the issue, but aren't following through.
Members of Congress don't want to give up that little perk. I mean, they want to be able to trade.
Magaziner says some just want to keep trading, but...
But there are plenty of other members who are not active stock traders, but have honest questions about, well, hey, if this passes, will I still be able to save for retirement? Will I still be able to save for my kids' college tuition? And the answer is yes.
And some, like Senate Majority Leader John Thune, point to current rules that require lawmakers to disclose any trades of stocks over $1,000 within 30 days as a sufficient guardrail.
I mean, we got some members up here on both sides of the aisle, both sides of the Capitol, as you know, who would like more strict limitations on that. But there are some pretty good, I would say, protections in place already.
More disclosures of lawmakers' trades around the tariffs are expected to become public later this month. And supporters say more public attention to congressional trading could be the tipping point for reform. Deirdre Walsh, NPR News, the Capitol.
This is NPR News.
Are we really in a loneliness epidemic? One expert says while increasing social isolation is a problem, just being alone may not be. The benefits of solitude, next time here and now.
Appointments get canceled, plans fall through, but NPR is always there with news you can trust live at the top of every hour. Listen on your phone at this station's website or npr.org.
Good morning, me Martinez. Cuttlefish is not a squid, but it kind of looks like one. Well, scientists studying some cuttlefish noticed them using four different arm movements to communicate with each other. In one, the cuttlefish wave their arms out to the side. In another, they stretch them up over their heads. Some scientists say the moves look like disco dancing. Easy way to know for sure. Did the cuttlefish also spell out the C and the A? It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Fisher Investments, Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. Fisherinvestments.com, Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Easy Cater, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from a nationwide network of restaurants, create lunch programs for their employees, and manage food spend at easycater.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. President Trump says he wants to reopen Alcatraz. The former prison is a mile and a half off the coast of San Francisco. The Federal Bureau of Prisons closed Alcatraz in 1963, saying it was nearly three times more expensive to operate than any other federal prison. It has no sewer system or fresh water, and all the water, fuel, and supplies have to be delivered by boat. Now, the island is one of the most popular national park sites in the country. Joining me now is Scott Wiener, a California state senator whose district is in San Francisco. So, Senator Wiener, what was your reaction to hearing the news that President Trump wanted to somehow reopen Alcatraz Prison?
This is truly a ridiculous proposal to make Alcatraz a prison again. It's like setting taxpayer money on fire. 1.4 million people a year visit Alcatraz. It's one of the most popular properties in the whole National Park Service. It's right up there with the Golden Gate Bridge in terms of attractions in San Francisco.
On Monday, the U.S. Bureau of Prisons says that they're going to pursue all avenues to try and see if they can make this happen for President Trump. Wondering what would have to happen on the local end for this to even be something that could be considered?
Yeah, it would be unbelievably expensive. I mean, they would have to remove the museum that's been there for more than half a century. And they'd have to build a new prison from scratch. The building that's there now is ancient. The salt water was actually starting to destroy the foundation of the building. It was going to have to need a huge public investment. And so they made the smart decision to say, let's not have a prison here anymore.
The president's goal is to put dangerous individuals away securely. Are there any other sites in California that if this is something that became a real thing that could accommodate these people that President Trump wants to put away?
Well, the question is, who is it that he wants to put away? He claims that a lot of people are dangerous who are not dangerous. He says he wants to deport 10 million immigrants, claiming that they're all criminals, which is false. And that's why it's concerning to me that he wants to create this new institution where Lord knows who he's going to put there, whether it's going to be his political opponents or just sweeping people up off the streets and not giving them due process and then refusing to follow court orders.
If it were at some point to become a federal prison again, what do you think that means to your constituents, to the city of San Francisco, to know that this is there, right there on the water for everyone to kind of look at?
My constituents are not going to be happy if Alcatraz is lost as a tourist destination, as a museum, as a place to go and learn about history. There's a whole economic ecosystem that exists around Alcatraz, the tour guides, the boats, all of the people whose livelihood depends on this popular federal attraction. And that'll all be taken away. So this is not a popular idea in San Francisco.
That is California State Senator Scott Wiener. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
And NPR reached out to the National Park Service for comment. In a statement, J. Elizabeth Peace said the Department of the Interior and the National Park Service has nothing to add at this time. The president's statement speaks for itself. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin.
Artificial intelligence for humanity, for profit, or something else?
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Affinity, provider of the CRM for the private capital relationship economy. Affinity knows who has the best relationship with the right startup. Affinity knows. Learn more at affinity.co/marketplace.
I'm David Brancaccio in Los Angeles. One of the biggest firms in artificial intelligence has hit a roadblock in its campaign to become a standard for-profit company. It's about the whole point of OpenAI, maker of ChatGPT. Is it helping humanity or making money? Marketplace's Nova Safo explains.
OpenAI's nonprofit board is a vestige of when it was created a decade ago to build artificial intelligence to, quote, benefit humanity. But OpenAI has needed tens of billions of dollars in investments to get there, and the investors who footed the bill have wanted to secure a stake in future profits and to have more of a say in OpenAI's governance. So in December, CEO Sam Altman said the ChatGPT maker would convert itself into a for-profit corporation, with its original nonprofit board becoming a shareholder. That prompted a lawsuit from Elon Musk, who was among OpenAI's early backers and its current rival with his own AI company. Now a new plan. The nonprofit board will remain in charge. The part of OpenAI that takes in investor money and runs ChatGPT is to become a subsidiary structured as a public benefit corporation. Those are certified to have a mission to do a public good while also making a profit for shareholders. I'm Nova Safo for Marketplace.
The bond market is down slightly as the Federal Reserve starts meeting today and again tomorrow to consider what to do about tariffs that can be both inflationary and recessionary at the same time. The Dow is down 130.3%. The S&P down 0.4%. The NASDAQ is down 0.5%. The key stock index in Frankfurt, Germany is down 0.5% amid the sense that the new leader of Germany, conservative Friedrich Merz, lost some clout today. This after it took not one but two rounds of voting in parliament there to get him in power. It's the first time a would-be chancellor lost a first round since the Second World War. 133 cardinals will enter the Sistine Chapel tomorrow to start choosing the next pope, and people around the world are placing millions of dollars in bets over who they think will get the two-thirds majority to become the Catholic Church's next leader. Marketplace's Elizabeth Trovall has more on papal betting markets.
People have been betting on who becomes the next pope for centuries, says John Holden with Indiana University. But
we've seen a much bigger expansion of betting on the Pope globally as technology's gotten better and allowed word to spread quickly.
Though papal bets are not allowed in U.S. sports books, many Americans are on Kalshi, a financial exchange and prediction market. Cardinal Pietro Parolin is the frontrunner there, which Victor Matheson with College of the Holy Cross says could be a good predictor.
Betting markets and prediction markets actually do a pretty good job at estimating what's going to happen.
Though there's one thing markets can't account for, says Father Tom Daly with the St. Charles Borromeo Seminary.
A really big factor that no one talks about because it's hard to talk about, and you certainly can't bet on, is the role that the Holy Spirit plays.
Because, he says, cardinals are meant to elect the person God wants to be the successor. I'm Elizabeth Trovall for Marketplace.
There's even a kind of fantasy football thing getting global interest, Fantapapa. If you go to the site, it reads, Chi sarà il prossimo pontefice? Who will be the next pontiff? It goes on in Italian, take up the challenge to bring out the Vatican expert within you.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Palo Alto Networks. Palo Alto Networks delivers comprehensive cybersecurity protection while automating cyber defense to stop threats so organizations can thrive. Learn more at paloaltonetworks.com.
One thing in common, U.S. and China, slowing birth rates. That may stress the environment a bit less, but that's fewer people working and paying taxes to pay for populations getting older. China's offering cash and more parental leave to encourage people to have more kids. Marketplace's China correspondent Jennifer Pack has been spending time with families in southern China.
It's a hot afternoon at a public square in Dongguan. This toddler and his mom, Mo Guilan, are taking a stroll.
I won't consider a second child for health and financial reasons.
China used to have a one-child policy. Now up to three are allowed. But Mo Guilan says even with one child, her family's already taken a financial hit.
There was nobody to help me take care of the baby after maternity leave, so I had to quit my factory job.
A lot of women worry about being able to keep their jobs after giving birth. Human resources executive Irene Yang says when she gave birth back in 2011, she was nervous about taking the 3 months maternity leave that she was entitled to.
Once I took that long maternity leave, my work was given to another person, and I worried that I could be replaced.
To make sure she didn't miss out on too much, she would go to the office during her maternity leave. Now she's in a senior HR role and a proud mom of a teenager.
After having one child, I didn't want more. It's like mission accomplished.
Because employers bear the cost of benefits like maternity leave, women can be discriminated against in the hiring process, says mom of one, Peng Lu.
At interviews, employers would ask my age, if I'm married yet, and if I have any children.
China's government officially bans such lines of questioning, but it still happens. Luckily, Peng Lu landed a job in the public sector, where women's rights are better protected. But even with that, she decided to quit after having her son and move back closer to her family so she wouldn't have to pay for expensive childcare. Now she's planning a second child. Some cities are offering thousands of dollars in subsidies to anyone having three children. Does that tempt Peng Lu? Probably not, she says. Ex-factory worker Mo Guilan feels the same.
I won't give birth to a child just for a few thousand dollars.
Raising kids, she says, costs way more than that. In Dongguan City, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
With the Federal Reserve starting its two-day meeting on interest rates today, listen to the half-hour edition of Marketplace with my colleague Kai Rizdal on Money on many, many public radio stations later today, or streamable for Marketplace online. It's a .org since we're a nonprofit. In Los Angeles, I'm David Brancaccio. It's the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.